Yeah, so we're going to start this exploration, which, as Lilamani said, is based on Divan's book. In a fit of unmindfulness, I forgot to ask our bookshop manager to order any copies, so we have no copies. So you can't buy the book yet, if you haven't already got it. But next week, we hope to have some copies. And it would be good if you did, in a way, follow what we're doing over these 5 weeks by reading the book. We're not going to stick completely to the book, but we will cover most of the ground in the 5 weeks, perhaps in a slightly different way. So I really recommend Divan's book. I think it's a very clear introduction to what is the central teaching of Buddhism. This teaching of conditionality that we're going to explore is, you could say, it's at the heart of Buddhism. It is the defining teaching of the Buddha. So Buddhism's spread across many cultures and countries and taken on quite different forms, hasn't it, over those different countries and cultures, to such a degree that if you were a sort of casual observer, you'd not recognise them as the same religion. You know, if you were practicing Zen in Japan and Sri Lankan Theravadan Buddhism, you wouldn't recognise them on the surface as the same religion at all. But there is an underlying thread to all forms of Buddhism. You could say that the underlying thread, the ultimate underlying thread, is the Buddha. The experience of the Buddha, of Bodhi, of enlightenment, is what all Buddhism is pointing us to. It's pointing us to that experience as a realizable experience for ourselves. So in that sense, there's an underlying unity in the form of the Buddha and the enlightenment that the Buddha comes to represent. But in terms of teaching, in terms of the teaching of the Buddha, the underlying unity is provided by this teaching of conditionality that we're going to be exploring. That is what all Buddhist teaching needs to be referring back to. Any Buddhist teaching that you hear or learn, you should be able to trace it back to this root teaching. And if it contradicts that root teaching, then it's not a Buddhist teaching, in a certain sense. Yeah. So all Buddhist teachings, however diverse, however multifarious, however wide and wonderful they are, they ought to be all traceable back to this principle. It's a principle rather than a teaching we're going to be exploring. Yeah. So in that sense, it lies at the heart of Buddhism. And that's not just me saying that. It's not even Sangharakshita saying that, although Sangharakshita has, I think one of his particular geniuses has been to see the underlying unity of Buddhism throughout all its schools. Until, I guess, relatively recently, those different schools had grown up in isolation. People simply didn't travel from Tibet to China very often. Schools hadn't really had very much contact since the first kind of sort of transmission. One of Sangharakshita's, I think, unique contributions to Buddhism is that he has seen the underlying unity of all Buddhist schools. And his perspective is that as modern Western Buddhists, in a sense, we have no choice but to be exposed to different Buddhist teachings. Because so many schools are represented, all the schools are represented in the West. And you've got so much information from books and the internet, etc., and different teachers, that if you're really going to be serious about exploring Buddhism, you need to make sense of it all. And in order to do that, you need the key that unlocks this sort of hidden unity behind all the diversity. And I think that's one of his sort of geniuses to do that. But it's not even just Sangharakshita who said that this teaching of conditionality was the central teaching. The Buddha himself said it. He said that he who sees conditionality sees the Dhamma. And he who sees the Dhamma sees conditionality. Yeah. He also then, in another sutta, says that he who sees the Dhamma sees me, i.e. the Buddha. And he who really sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma. So he's equating this teaching with the heart of his teaching. Not just his teaching, but the heart of the way things are, with reality itself. And he's saying, if you really see this teaching, then you see reality. And if you really see reality, you see the Buddha. You see the Buddha as he really is. Yeah? Not just his outer form, or not just a symbol. You see his mind, because you experience what his mind experienced. In fact, you become a Buddha, if you really, really see it, and you allow the teaching to transform you. So that's what Buddhism's aiming at. Buddhism, all of Buddhism, is saying we can experience what the Buddha experienced. Yeah. So this teaching is known in various ways. This is a very classic kind of way in which it's phrased. It's known as the teaching of Paticca-samuppada, which the scholar Konza translated as conditioned co-production. Conditioned co-production. And I don't know if you can read it from the back, but I've written it up in Pali and then in English. Pali is the language in which the oldest Buddhist texts have come down to us. And I think it's quite lovely to at least see what it looks like in that oldest form. So I'll just read it out. It says, Imas min sati idam hoti, imas upada idam upachati, imas min asati idam nahoti, imas aniroda idam niruchati. Which is normally translated as this being, that becomes, from the arising of this, that arises, this not being, that does not become, from the ceasing of this, that ceases. Yeah. And that's it. That is it in terms of the heart of the Buddha's teaching. So if you were really paying attention, the light bulb should have flashed on there, and you would have said, oh yes, that is the nature of all things. But it doesn't look like that happened tonight. that's because, well, it's for various reasons. It's for various reasons, and I'll explore some of those reasons. But obviously this is a highly, highly condensed form of the teaching. It's condensed into its kind of barest minimum form. And it's not easy to see the implications of this when it's put so baldly. Yeah? It reads like some sort of scientific law or something, but it's not obvious to know why this should be the words, the teaching that have moved millions and millions of people to practice the Dharma and led to such extraordinary cultural development, such flourishing, such enlightenment. So the first thing I want to say is that we need to think about this teaching at three levels. We need to think about it at three levels. And then perhaps we can start to see its sort of significance. Yeah. So the first level is the experience of enlightenment. It's the mind of the Buddha. It's the experience that made him a Buddha, that turned Siddhartha Gautama into the Buddha under the Bodhi tree 2,500 years ago. It's an experience that can't be caught in words. It can't be caught in concepts. It's a direct, immediate understanding. More than an understanding, it's a direct, unmediated, immediate experience of truth. And there's no words that can capture that. Actually, there are no words that can capture any experience. So I've just got a glass of water, and I take a sip, and there's no words that can capture that experience of water in my mouth. Yeah? It's a familiar experience, and it may not seem a very profound one, but try and describe it, and you always fall short. You always fall short. There's no amount of words, however beautiful or evocative, that will give you the same sensations, the same experience, as actually tasting the water yourself. Yeah? So it's not just that enlightenment is this privileged experience, although in many ways it is. It's not just that enlightenment can't be caught in words. Actually, no experience can be caught in words. No experience can be caught in words. And that might seem obvious, but I think we forget that. We forget that very easily, and we think that words are the reality themselves. We forget that words are just pointers, they're metaphors, they're vehicles for communicating experiences. But the experiences themselves, I am happy, you're happy, it's a nice day, etc. The experience themselves of happiness, of being a nice day, is not capturable by words. Yeah? So at its highest, at its loftiest, at its ultimate, the Buddha's experience is, it's called Atata Vachara, which means realizable in concepts. There are no concepts or words that can, it's beyond all concepts and words. But the Buddha wanted to communicate his experience to others. Actually, he hesitated, didn't he? He hesitated. As the legend goes, he had this profound awakening under the Bodhi tree, and he started to... he absorbed the experience over a number of weeks, days and weeks. But then he doubted whether he would be able to communicate it to anybody else. He sort of cast his eye around at the world and said that the world was too bound up with craving. People in the world were too bound up with craving, and they wouldn't be able to understand a teaching as subtle as this, an experience as subtle as this. He thought he wouldn't be able to communicate it. And the legend goes that he was on the verge of deciding to just rest in his experience, to rest in nirvana, and not bother trying to communicate it. And then, of course, the legend goes that Brahma Sahampati, who's one of the gods, one of the king of the gods, comes down and says, "No, Lord, there are some people who will understand." He says that there are some people with just... but little dust on their eyes, and they will understand if you teach them. And so then the Buddha decides to teach. So the Buddha did want to then communicate. I mean, the legend, I think it's interesting. If you take it at a psychological level, I think this legend tells you something about the nature of the Buddha's experience, what was going on for him. It's as if there's an aspect of enlightenment which wants to just rest in this freedom and this bliss, and then there's an aspect of enlightenment which is compelled to return to the world to try and help others. Yeah, and they seem to be contradictory aspects. And I think this legend kind of points to that. So the Buddha wanted to communicate, but he realized that words were hostages to fortune, that if you use words, then you can be misunderstood. The words can be misunderstood. The words can be misapplied, they can be twisted, they can be taken out of context and misunderstood. So it's almost as if he wanted to use the words that were least likely to be misunderstood. And one of the things that Bhante Sangharakshita says is that this set of words, had the Buddha said any more than this about what's going on, had he said any more than this, he would have been open to falling into misunderstanding. He would have been open to communicating a wrong view, a view at all, because this is actually said to be beyond all views. So he would have fallen into communicating something. He would have falsified something if he'd said any more than this. That's what I'm trying to say. If he'd said any less than this, he would have had to remain silent. So this is this very, very fine line between saying what you can say in order to communicate something, but not saying so much that you can be misunderstood or misapplied. So at this level, this is the second level, we have some words. And these words point to a concept. And this concept we can talk about. We can talk about, we can discuss with our reason and our rationality, we can explore its meaning, etc. And that's partly what we're going to do over the next few weeks. Yeah? But it's the second level. The words are not the experience. And the idea of the words, the reason that the Buddha said these words, is not because he wanted us to just reason about them. He wanted us to use the words as a doorway into the experience itself. Yeah? So the words are a doorway. They're a metaphor pointing to the experience itself. And that's the second level. We have this general formula of paticcasamuppada, which is as general as it can be, and it's pointing to an experience. And I'm going to say a little bit more about that after tea. And then there's one more level that we're also going to be exploring in this seminar, which is applications of this general formula into different situations. So the Buddha took this general formula and he applied it to different human situations. And those applications form much of the teaching of Buddhism. So there are three levels, and we're going to be looking primarily at the second and the third level with a hope that if you really start to reflect deeply on this teaching, you can start to perhaps get a glimpse into the experience that the Buddha himself had. Yeah? Okay, let's have a cup of tea, and then we'll come back and we'll begin properly. Let me just read you. So there's this passage that I just want to read you from this book, The Survey of Buddhism, which is Sangharakshita's sort of magnum opus. It's a book that I think is magnificent in its scope and its depth, in its insight, ranging over the whole of the Buddhist tradition and penetrating into what's essential about the Dharma. It was written, I think, when he was in his mid-20s, and it's a truly extraordinary work that stood the test of time and scholarship and all the rest of it. He writes in a rather 19th century style, so I'm just going to read you a bit, but be warned, the sentences are sort of long, and there's sort of sub-clauses and things like that, but we don't do anymore. So he's talking about the essence of enlightenment. If Bodhi, is insight into the true nature of phenomena. What is the nature of that insight? Before attempting to answer this question, around which revolves all that is most vital in Buddhism, we must clearly understand that this insight is a purely spiritual attainment, and that it has nothing to do with any kind of conceptual construction. Though described by the Buddha in terms comprehensible to the intellect, it would be a mistake of the most disastrous kind to imagine that it was even remotely akin to the intellectual understanding of phenomena possessed, for example, by students of physical science. Such descriptions are symbolical merely, reflecting, as though through darkness well-nigh impenetrable, only a faint glimmer of the infinite light of his realization. Having given this preliminary warning, we may state that the knowledge and insight attained by the Buddha beneath the Bodhi tree at Gaya consisted in what, by way of an accommodation to the normal conceptual mode of human thought, he described as the truth that all phenomena arise in dependence on conditions. He described as the truth that all phenomena arise in dependence on conditions. In the original Pali, all dhamma are paticca samuppada. This is the great Buddhist doctrine of paticca samuppada, a term variously rendered by scholars. Konza translates it as condition co-production, an equivalent more accurate and euphonious than many others. As the primary formulation of the Buddha's enlightenment on the intellectual plane, it is the historical and logical basis of all later developments in Buddhist philosophy. In a text which we shall quote later, it has been equated with the Dharma itself. So that's Bhante writing in the 1940s about Paticcasamuppada being the essence of the Buddha's enlightenment, but making it very clear that any conceptual construction is not the experience itself, that it's merely a metaphor pointing to an experience, and that it would be, as he says, a mistake of the most disastrous kind if we were to start taking this as literally what the Buddha meant, if you see what I mean. If we start taking this in the wrong way, we mistake all of Buddhism. Yeah? If we take it in the right spirit, it opens a doorway to the experience that he had. So I want to just pause there and see if there are any questions or anything that occurs to you so far. I want to just make sure that you're with me so far, and then we're going to move on to start exploring this a little bit more.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, James.
The quote that you just read out, you said that, Bhante says, that it was a spiritual realisation. So what exactly do you think he means by that? Could you say a bit more about it?
Well, I guess the word that we can most easily relate to is experience, that it was an experience. It was a direct experience. It was a bit like, Subhuti said this, that it was a bit like the Buddha was in a particular, the Buddha is having this particular experience, if you say, or is a particular experience. And from that experience, it's as if he looks at the world around him. And if he wants to describe the world around him in the most general terms, then he would say something like, all phenomena are arising and ceasing in dependence upon conditions. And it's this sense that everything is flowing, and that nothing is either static or fundamental, that everything is somehow related to conditions that preceded it and will evaporate or cease when those conditions also cease. But the actual realization goes beyond any of those words. It goes beyond any of those words. I mean, maybe another analogy would be, you know how you sometimes wake up from a dream, and the dream had a definite felt sense to it. It was a definite experience that you can still sort of remember an echo of. It's left you feeling something. But you can't put that feeling into words. There's a definite sense that something's happened, but you can't put it into words. So that would be a very, very pale reflection of what experience means in this context. But then, experience isn't a very good word, because normally, when we think of experience, our language implies that there's somebody having the experience, and it's an experience of something. The word implies that. But the Buddha's experience doesn't fit that category. It isn't an experience of something, and it's not that there was somebody having the experience. Enlightenment is when there's a transcendence of that whole subject and object framework. So it's not like somebody having an experience of something outside of them. It's a seeing through that whole framework itself. So in that sense, there's no good word to describe it. There's no good word at all to describe it. So from that perspective, it's a spiritual experience, because it's not like the experience of just drinking a glass of water, which I can describe in terms of me and glass of water. Bhante calls it a transcendental experience, because it transcends our normal framework of subject and object, of person and thing, of experiencer and something that's experienced. So that probably that doesn't help, but it's a few more words. Yeah.
Don't we all understand that things are going to sort of one day be dust, that things are going to pass away, we're all here?
Yeah.
How isn't that a natural thing for us to understand?
And sort of straightforward.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, at one level we do, don't we? At one level we do. It's interesting that there's a sutta in the canon where Ananda, the Buddha's attendant and companion, says to him that Ananda's not enlightened at this point, and he says to the Buddha, "Lord, these are my words. I can't remember the exact words. It's all great, actually, or it's all marvelous, your teaching." Pratichatsamapada, this dependent origination, it's very profound, and yet it seems to me it's very obvious, it's very clear, very easy to understand. And the Buddha said to him, "No, don't say that, Ananda. It's not easy to understand. It's because people don't understand this, it's because they don't see the truth of this, that they're tangled up in suffering, that this world is full of suffering." So what the Buddha's saying is that if we really understood what he was getting at through these words, we would be free from suffering. So how I understand that, or one way of thinking about this, is that intellectually I know that I'm going to die. And intellectually I know that everybody around me is going to die. And I've known that probably since I was sort of so high, intellectually, as it were. But I don't live my life as if that were true. I mean, really true. And I don't sort of go through my day thinking, I must really make the most of this day, because I don't know how many more days there are in this life. And I must really make sure that I act from the best in me, because I don't want to leave behind regrets. And I must really make sure that all my interactions are characterized by kindness, because that's the only value that there is in the face of the fact that we're mortal. If I really understood death and mortality, I'd live from that. And this is similar. If we really understood this, we'd be free from all attachment. We'd be free from all wanting for life to go in a certain way. I'd be quite happy to give away my iPhone Model 2 or whatever it is and not feel any twinge loss. And similarly, when I lose other things, even people, or my own life, I wouldn't feel any sense of loss. So that would be then a real understanding of this truth. It's like our understanding is very surface, it's paper thin. Yeah. But I'm glad you asked that question, because I think that, well, as the Sutta says, Ananda, all those years ago, was sort of asking the same question, and the Buddha was saying, no, you don't understand. Not really. And I think sometimes we do get a glimpse. So, I don't know, you know, if you experience a bereavement, or you experience an ending of a relationship, or you experience some sort of hiatus in your life, sometimes it does cause us to stop and say, ah, what's going on? What's really important in my life? I was talking to Lilamani earlier today, and if you've ever experienced a bereavement, as well as the grief and the sort of trauma, there are times when you're, well, this is my experience, when I'm in touch with the beauty of the world and its mystery, and a sense that I don't know what life is, and somehow that feels precious. Yeah, we can start to take these seemingly very easy truths a little bit deeper at those times. And Buddhist practice is about not waiting for the bereavements or the ending of a relationship or some sort of trauma. It's about training ourselves through practice to take these reflections deeper, so that we can wake up and make the most of our lives now. Yeah. Perhaps I'll say a little bit more about that. So from a Buddhist perspective, the reason that we don't all immediately wake up to freedom and bliss on hearing these words, because Buddhism says it is possible. I mean, there's a sutta where Shariputra, when he first hears the Dharma, hears it from a man called Asaji. And Shariputra hasn't met the Buddha yet. He's wandering, looking for a teacher of truth. He meets this man, Asaji, and he's impressed by how Asaji is holding himself and how radiant he looks and how composed and mindful he appears. And he says to Asaji, who is your teacher, and tell me his teaching. And Asaji just says, he doesn't use these words, he uses another formulation which is equally famous or equally well known, or perhaps even more so. He says, those things conditionally arisen, the realized one has told their cause, and the ceasing of them too, This is the great renouncer's teaching. Those things conditionally arisen from a cause, the realized one has explained their cause, and the ceasing of them too. And Shariputra hears this, and he gains insight. He becomes a stream entrant on the spot. Asaji has said that he himself is new, and he says, look, I don't really understand, but this is what the Buddha teaches. And Shariputra immediately does realise. And the reason that that's possible is because Shariputra's mind was already well primed, if you see what I mean. It was well ready for this teaching to go right in. Whereas most of the time, our minds are not receptive enough. They're not ready enough. They're not fit enough for this teaching, or any Buddhist teaching, to go right in. So for us, most of the time, Buddhism is about developing a mind that is bright enough, radiant enough, clear enough, calm enough, metaful enough, yeah, so emotionally positive enough, loving enough, flexible enough, pliable enough, creative enough, imaginative enough, to hear a teaching and then for that teaching to go in. And not just to go in, but to go right in and transform us. Now that's quite a different notion of truth than a Western notion of truth. A Western notion of truth is that your state of mind, regardless of your state of mind, you can understand something if you can grapple with it intellectually. If it can be explained to you in intellectual terms that you can grasp, then you've got it. Yeah? Whereas Buddhism is saying, no, that's just the surface level of things. To gain a deeper realization of things, your mind has to be appropriately conditioned. It has to be an appropriate mind. Otherwise, you just don't see the truth. So we don't see the truth because our mind is not ready to see the truth. So meditation, ethics, reflection, study, all the practices of Buddhism are about developing a mind that can see the truth. Really see the truth. And then what Buddhism asks us to do is it says when you're in that sort of state of mind, really, really clear, bright, concentrated, calm, collected, radiantly positive, full of metta, full of shraddha, when you're in that state of mind, then just turn something like this over, contemplate it. You don't even have to think about it, but drop it in into your mind and let it reverberate. Let it reverberate. So any more questions or thoughts on anything I've said? Yeah.
I think one of the problems with this sentence is that we are thinking in materialistic, scientific materialistic way.
Yeah.
So we're thinking in like laws of cause and effect.
Yeah.
And we read it like the law of cause and effect, which has naturally nothing to do with what he's actually trying to, what he's trying to say, I believe. And because it's not really about the causality of it, which is actually inherent in what's happening, but it's not the point.
Mm.
The point is a transformation.
Mm.
Where when, if there wasn't a disability of things that ceasing, wouldn't be any transformation. So the transformation is only possible because we can put a stop of it. I mean, we can stop put a stop to the dukkha.
Yeah.
So this is. I'm not very good at explaining this actually. Mm.
No, I think you've got something there.
But I think the point is to do with the transformation of ourselves.
That's right.
Rather than to do with the causality of it.
Right. So you've said two really important things there. I'm going to just expand on both of them. So first of all, you said that this isn't, it's not like a materialist teaching. It's not like a scientific materialist teaching. And that's absolutely true. So it's not like physics or environmental sciences saying that, you know, you release greenhouse gases into the air and you get global warming. Of course, that is a causal relationship, and global warming does have conditions. But the Buddha wasn't that interested in how the universe worked at a material level. Yeah? And he came from a perspective that included the material, but also said that there was more than matter, that there was something, consciousness couldn't be reduced to matter. But the Buddha, and then what you said, is that the Buddha was primarily concerned about transformation of us, so that we would be free from suffering. He wasn't a philosopher in the sense of somebody trying to develop a metaphysical doctrine that explained the cosmos. That wasn't his intention, that wasn't his interest, that wasn't his aim. He was saying, you can be free of all suffering, of all mental suffering. Of course, while you've got a body, there will still be physical pain, but you can be free of all other suffering. You can be liberated. The reason that we're not free of all suffering is because of certain causes and conditions. And he's trying to point out that transformation. He's trying to, in a way, trigger that transformation in us. Yeah? So yes, it's really important to remember that Buddhism isn't some sort of philosophy. It's not a metaphysics. The Buddha wasn't a metaphysician. He's not trying to explain physics or science in that sense of the word. That's not to say that it's not compatible with science and things, but that wasn't the Buddha's intention or aim. That's not what he's primarily concerned about. Sam, yeah?
Can you go a bit further with the difference between cause and effect?
Yeah.
And also where free intention fits into that?
Yeah. Well, firstly, before I sort of say more about cause and effect, I want to say the distinction between conditionality and causality. Causality is the doctrine of cause and effect. Conditionality is broader than that. Conditionality says there are all sorts of conditions behind any phenomena happening. So let me just give you an example. Say somebody dies of a heart attack. Somebody dies of a heart attack. You could, if you were just thinking in terms of causality, say that the cause of death was the heart attack. Yeah? But if you were thinking in terms of conditionality, it's much broader. You would say, what are the conditions that led to that death? And then you could start thinking, well, what are the conditions that led to the heart stopping? Yeah? And that might include diet, that might include lifestyle, that might include stress, that might include genetic factors, that might include...
he was alive. That's a condition.
A condition that he was alive in the first place. You can think much, much broadly about all the conditions behind an event. You wouldn't necessarily say that the fact that he was alive led to the death, caused the death. But you could say it was a condition for the death. Yeah? So there's a difference between conditionality and causality. Conditionality is much, much broader. It's looking at all the conditions that contribute to any event. And this teaching is about conditionality. So I'll sort of come back to your question a bit in a bit, so hang on to it. But I just want to explore this condition cause thing, and then I'll come back to the free will thing. So just think about, for the moment, all the conditions that led you to being here tonight. Yeah? Led you to being here tonight. So some of those conditions are perhaps sort of quite sort of obvious. Like you decided that you wanted to come to Dharma Night. You were interested in this seminar. You are interested in deepening your understanding of Buddhism. You had nothing else to do on a Monday. Better to do on a Monday. But then other conditions, you could go further back and say, well, what is it in your life that has sparked an interest in meditation and Buddhism? Yeah. And then you'd have to start thinking about a whole range. I mean, it'll be different, obviously, for each one of us. But a whole range of kind of conditions, perhaps going back into childhood, that triggered this interest. You could go further back, and, well, the fact that your parents had you, that you were born at all, is one of the conditions, preconditions, to you being here tonight. But then your parents had to meet, and all the conditions that went into not only them meeting, but them deciding to have you, or not deciding to have you, but having you anyway. All of the conditions that led to that are also part of you being here tonight, yeah? And you can go back and back and back in time and outwards in space to look at all the conditions that contributed to you being here tonight. And there's no... from a Buddhist perspective, there's no stopping point. There's no first point. You could say the first point, from a scientific perspective, was the Big Bang. The universe had to come into existence for you to be here tonight. Yeah? But Buddhism says that before the Big Bang, there were other universes, as it were. So there's no first point. Now, that's just one person. That's just you, as it were. But then think that there are about 40 people in this room who have all come together here tonight. And that meant all of those conditions together in this unique combination that will probably never be repeated again. This is a unique event with all of those conditions coming together. This infinite net and complexity of conditions coming together and changing all the time. So that's conditionality rather than causality. Conditionality is this vast perspective that includes everything, that's contributing to everything. I'm still going to finish, Sam. I want to finish. So there's something about conditionality that I think is mind-boggling if you start to contemplate everything that it's pointing to. Yeah? It's incredible in its vastness, so much so that it's beyond us to trace all of the conditions. You know, we might be able to trace one line through that, but that's probably all that we can do. So that's the difference between conditionality and causality. But then you were asking about free will, weren't you? And how do we affect this? Well, from a Buddhist perspective, it's not just that all of those conditions are just material phenomena and atoms banging into each other. Part of the conditions is our free will, our mind. Now, Buddhism doesn't talk in terms of free will or lack of free will, but it does talk in terms of will. It talks in terms of chetana. And that's an essential part of the conditions for any event concerning you. So you coming here tonight, one of the essential conditions was your will. Yeah? And Buddhism says that we have choice. Now, metaphysically and philosophically, this might become problematic. You could say, who has choice? How do we have choice? Etc. But practically, what Buddhism says is that we do have choice. And that choice is essential. It's the crux of the whole matter. Because it's because we've got choice that we can choose to create conditions that are going to be favourable or unfavourable. If we didn't have a choice, there'd be nothing to do in a way. We'd just carry on living in a sort of automatic pilot way. But it's because we've got choice that Buddhism says enlightenment is a possibility. Because we can actively choose conditions. If you understand how conditions affect you, then you can be intelligent about the sort of conditions you choose. And you can actively choose conditions that help you grow towards enlightenment. Yeah. And that's where the whole of the Buddhist path is about choosing conditions that are favourable conditions. And choice is a part of that. Yeah. So really important thing. This isn't deterministic. It's not saying all of things are set and we don't have any choice in this. It's quite the reverse. Of course you can't choose everything. A lot of things are already set. And we can't change them now. But we do have a choice in the moment about certain things. And that we need to exercise intelligently. And mindfulness, meditation, metta, are all about trying to make an intelligent choice. The whole notion of karma in Buddhism, which we're going to come on to week after next, probably, is about volitional choices, choices that we've made and the effects that they have. So Buddhism is saying that, you know, we can choose wisely or unwisely. A lot of the time, we're not together enough to make a wise choice. It's as if we're so scattered in our minds, we're so contradicted, we're so sort of split in our minds, that we can't make those wise choices. Yeah? Part of us wants to meditate, part of us just wants to sit and play with my iPhone apps. Speaking not very personally. You know, we're split, and therefore we don't always make the wise choice. Part of Buddhism, in fact an essential part of Buddhism, is to become more and more integrated so that we can make wise choices about our life. So choice is an essential aspect of conditionality. So two things that we've explored there. Difference between conditionality and causality in a sort of ordinary Western scientific kind of terms. And this notion that not everything is fixed, that we've got choice. And we can intelligently apply this and say, well, what conditions help me grow? Okay, I'm going to move on. I'm going to move on because I want to just explore something that follows on from what I've just been saying. So, Sangharakshita takes this notion of conditionality as the fundamental Buddhist teaching, and then he identifies in the scriptures two types or modes of conditionality, two ways in which conditionality operates, seems to operate. Yeah, modes is the best word that I can think of, two modes of conditionality. So does anybody know what those two modes are? No?
Arising and ceasing.
Arising and ceasing. Although you could, I can see why you might say that, because they are two modes of conditionality, so that's not wrong, but that's not the one that he's getting at. What he's getting at is that there's a mode of conditionality which is where things arise and cease, but they stay on the same level, they stay in samsara. They stay in on the same sort of level. There's no spiritual growth involved. Yeah? So things arise and cease, but there's no spiritual growth. So, my life before I started practicing Buddhism was pretty much on that level. Things did arise and cease, but mostly they were to do with my job, my friends, my social life, the house, the mortgage, the car, the holiday, good times, bad times, stresses, strains, promotions, drinking binges, etc., etc. So there were a whole heap of conditions that I could say was my life. But in a certain sense, they all existed on this one level, yeah, that we call samsara, that we call life, actually. And if it's going well, we say, oh, it's a good life. And if it's going badly, we say, oh, that's not very good as a life. But it's the samsaric level. And the Buddha said this was samsara. There's birth, there's death, and there's stuff in between. Yeah? And it just goes on and round. And you see it everywhere. And he said that ultimately that's unsatisfactory, even painful. It doesn't fulfill. But there is a whole level of conditionality that just operates at that level. And Bhante Sangharakshita calls it cyclic conditionality because it implies this cycle of birth and death and birth and death and birth and death and things in between, the houses, the holidays, the cars, in between. But then there's another level at which conditionality operates, and you have to actually usually start deliberately choosing this level, this mode, I mean. And this mode of conditionality is where you start to set in place the conditions that lead to spiritual growth. And ultimately, they lead to enlightenment. They take you beyond your normal everyday existence into higher and higher modes of consciousness. They develop your mind so that you start to be transformed, as you were saying. And ultimately, they can lead us all the way to enlightenment. So there's a whole path there. And you're already on that path by being here tonight, by meditating. You're already introducing conditions into your life that are leading you upwards in terms of your consciousness, in terms of becoming more aware, becoming more kind, becoming more integrated, becoming more positive, etc. You're already doing that. And that too is a mode of conditionality in the universe. It's a natural law that if you behave ethically and start to develop awareness that your mind will become more integrated and bright and clear. That's a natural conditioned phenomenon. So he calls that mode of conditionality the spiral mode because it spirals upwards, leading ultimately to enlightenment. So it's as if conditionality operates in these two ways. There's the wheel, and then arising from the wheel, there's a spiral. And there's a point where you can make a choice. Do I want to just go for another drink on a Monday night, or do I want to go to a class and meditate? Yeah, there's a choice. And in a way, there's a choice every moment as to which direction you want the conditionality to unfold in. Yeah? It's all conditionality, but you've got a choice, and you can influence that direction. And what Bhante says is that the Buddhist life, the essence of the Buddhist life, he calls it going for refuge to the three jewels, to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. But the essence of the Buddhist life is moving more and more from the cyclic mode to the spiral mode. Ideally, in every moment, you make the wise choice to move towards growth. Growth of consciousness, growth of being, growth of your humanity. You make that choice. That's what Buddhism consists of. Making that choice from cyclic conditionality to spiral conditionality in the moment, ideally every moment. Of course, this side of enlightenment, we won't do it every moment. Yeah? Those, in fact, sometimes those moments where we can make the wise choice feel few and far between. What normally happens is that we might make that wise choice and we go a little way up a spiral, but then we come back down and somebody, you know, gives us the iPhone and we're back in that cyclic kind of mode of craving, of wanting, of trying to get fulfillment in a way that won't last. So that's the essence of the Buddhist life. So already you can see that what we're doing is taking this very, very sort of pith teaching and starting to unpack some of the consequences. We're saying that this has two modes, and the essence of the Buddhist life is to make the choice for the spiral mode. Yeah? So probably I'm going to leave it there, and then next week we're going to explore this wheel and this spiral mode in more detail, because there are symbols associated with these two modes. With the cyclic mode, you've got the wheel of life, which some of you will be familiar with, and with the spiral mode, you've got something called the spiral path. And the spiral path, and in both the wheel of life and in the spiral path, you get sort of a detail of the conditions involved in those two modes. So we're going to be looking at those two modes in more detail next week. So I just want to pause again and take any final questions, but see if they can be questions rather than comments. Yeah.
From what you just said, you suggested that if somebody goes into a spiral and then goes back to, so say, the iPhone or whatever, they get back to the samsara. But isn't the idea behind what achieving nirvana is that once you overcome, that never reverses?
Yeah, there is that idea. That's right. So when we look at the spiral next week. In a way, ask that again, but on the spiral, as I say, normally we go up and we go down again, but there can come a point, I'm going to call it there, which is the point of no return, and that's where stream entry happens, as it were. And it's said that if you go up this spiral and you reach that point, then you will never fall completely back down. Now, you might go down a bit, but you'll never completely get lost in samsara again. Because at that point, you have a deep enough insight into the truth of this for you never to be able to lose it. Yeah? I mean, to use the analogy of death, which I know is a bit, you know, sobering, but to use an analogy of death, probably there comes a point where if you do lose somebody close to you, you can never quite be the same again. You can never be quite the same again. Something has gone deeper and you know that death is a truth, a universal truth. That's an analogy for an insight going deeper and changing you sort of permanently. Well, stream entry would be a point where you realise the truth of the Dharma so deeply that you can't fall back. It's interesting that stream entry is still a long, long, long way from enlightenment. So it's not the end of the road by any means. In some ways, it's just the beginning. But it's still a very significant point. Ben?
So you say that in each moment we have choices.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if the choices are that, well, sometimes we have a choice, but actually we might believe that we don't have a choice.
Right.
And also sometimes that choice may be a tremendously precious thing.
Yeah.
But we don't realise its preciousness. I think it's a trivial thing.
Yeah.
You know, like, should I read this particular newspaper that's discarded on this train.
Yeah.
You might read the paper and get deeply upset. But the actual choice, should I, could we, anyway, dismiss. Sometimes I make reckless choices because I just think, six or one half
doesn't matter.
Yes. And in fact, later I realised that actually that choice was very precious.
Yeah.
I could just slow down a little bit.
That's fine. So two things there I think are really important that you've said, and then we really will stop. So the first thing is that, yes, theoretically in the moment, every moment we have a choice, but in practice, the mind that we've got at the moment is conditioned by all the choices that we've made in the past. And all of those choices in the past, some of them have become habitual. So if we keep choosing in a certain sort of way, it's like we carve furrows in our mind. And if they're negative furrows, they're ruts. And if we get into a habitual rut, it can be very difficult to make the choice to come out of it. Yeah? Addiction is an example of a habit that's got so strong that it's very difficult to get out of. And addiction just doesn't, it's not just about things like smoking and drinking. Addiction, we also get addicted to certain states of mind and ways of being. So in practice, making the wise choice can be tremendously difficult. Buddhism offers you tools to help you. One of those tools is meditation. Because one of the things you mentioned is if you could only stop or slow down enough, then you might make the wise choice. Meditation helps you slow your mind down to the point where you can see the thoughts happening and decide whether you want to follow that thought or not. Yeah, and that can be an essential tool. The other really essential thing that Buddhism offers is a system of ethics, where if you realize that ethical actions lead to positive states of mind, then you don't dismiss them so much as trivial. You can start deliberately doing the kind or the generous thing or the considerate thing, even though if it feels tiny, in the knowledge that you're building up a positive habit and a positive momentum, which then helps you develop a mind that is more positive. Yeah. So a lot of Buddhism is about learning to, in a way, slow down and then learning to make that wise choice, sometimes against the odds. Sometimes we won't be able to because the habits are so strong. So it's much, much easier said than done, as we all know. Okay, what I want to do is just finish by just sitting for a couple of minutes. And we're just going to, in a way, come back into our bodies and notice how we are before we leave the room and go off on our journey home. Let's try and just leave in silence, at least leave this room in silence. You can talk when you're outside.